Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back.
Wouldn't you just love if everything was so easy when you were deciding to buy or sell your house? Yeah, that's how we feel too. That's why we have teamed up with the Richards Group, and they are our sponsors for this episode and many more to come. And we are so ever grateful to them. So check them out, therichardsgroup.ca.
Welcome to The Afterglow. When researching for this podcast, we heard our guest, Selena Cesar Chavan, say that if you're going to be the one to break the glass ceiling, you can expect yourself to get cut. That certainly was the case for Selena. Selena was the former Member of Parliament with the Government of Canada, representing the town of Whitby, a suburb east of Toronto. As a Liberal MP, she served as Parliamentary Secretary to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau from December 2015 to January 2017. And she also served as the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of International Development et la Francophonie from January 2017 to August 2018. As the only elected Black female amongst the 338 seats in the House of Commons, she somehow found the courage to speak out against racism and white privilege while speaking up for equity, diversity, and the particular issue of repealing mandatory minimums which disproportionately affect Blacks, Indigenous, and other people of color. But she found herself unheard and silenced, struggling to fight in a system that she says was not designed for her. Eventually, she left the Liberal Party and sat as an independent member of Parliament from March 2019 until the end of her term in October. As an MP, Selena advocated for people suffering with mental illness and was awarded the Champion of Mental Health Parliamentarian by the Canadian Alliance on Mental Illness and Mental Health. Her advocacy related to equity and justice resonated in Canada and around the world, as she was also named one of the most influential people of African descent, Global 100 Under 40 Politics and Governance, and Black Parliamentarian of the Year in 2017. She was also featured in the April 2018 edition of O, Oprah Winfrey's magazine, entitled What Would You Stand Up For? Selena currently serves as the Senior Advisor of Equity, Diversity, Inclusion Initiatives, and Adjunct Lecturer at Queen's University. Her best-selling book, Can You Hear Me Now?, was released in February 2021. Oh, we can hear you, Selena, and we think you should too. Listen up.
Welcome to The Afterglow.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're so thrilled. We just think you are like just such a super force, superpower. I don't know, superhero. There's got to be a superhero name for you for sure, because there's so many things that you've done. And just looking at your bio, it's like, is this woman like 85 years old? Like, how has she accomplished so many things? So
That's a little catch 22 though, right? Because I look at my bio and I'm kind of like, well, you haven't really stayed somewhere for a long time, right? So that, like, in my head, I see it and I'm like, so what are you an expert at?
Life.
Life. But also think about your impact in all these areas, right? It's almost like the universe is pushing you to move somewhere else because you kind of had your impact here and now you're moving somewhere else, right?
Yeah. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. That's very profound.
Well, because of your bio, we have a lot to cover.
Yes.
In this podcast, right. You know, okay. No, that's okay. No, we're business,
politics, entrepreneurship, and we want to start right at the beginning with your childhood.
Very good place to start.
Yeah, start at the very beginning. You know, so tell us about your early experience of moving to Canada from Grenada, from the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. As a young child, you were 2 years old. So tell us about your early experiences here in Canada, and particularly around the influences that were important to you, your grandmother and your mother.
Yeah. So, you know, I have very, of course, very like sort of salient memories of my youth and growing up. And, you know, I think the most important one for me was just remembering like the apartment that we lived in, which I guess it's seared into my memory because you come from Grenada and it's like lush and tropical and mangoes and, you know, beach. And then you're like in a, you know, whatever story apartment in Toronto and you're kind of like, what? This is Canada?
And it was January, I think, too, that you moved
like,
here.
Step your game up, man. Right? So yeah, and it's January. But from a kid's point of view, who cares what it is? Like, you brought me from there to here. Man, it looks like I'm going to have to fight my way through. And I think I've always been a fighter. And that's why I appreciated my grandmother, who was like this fierce, you know, sort of powerful woman who didn't take crap from anybody and who kind of like, you know, just marched to the beat of her own drum. And, you know, I just thought, I want to be her. Like, I have to be her when I grow up. But then now I have to get through all of this other stuff in this foreign place, you know, my strict mother who, I mean, you know, thinking about it at the time was like, really, you're kind of too strict for me. But when I, you know, the line that I use in my book is that, you know, I feared her while she feared for me because I'm, you know, you're one girl child in this big country. And so really just, I think I knew from a very early age that I have to keep hustling in order to stay ahead of the curve and to create whatever success was, however I defined it at that time.
Can you tell us a little bit about those particular qualities that you mentioned about your grandmother, like what they were and why they sort of struck you so deeply?
Yeah, she seemed very independent. So I knew that my grandfather and her had like a deep, profound love for each other, but she called the shots. So it was kind of like, I see you two, but I know who wears the pants here, right? My grandfather was really soft and cuddly and the squishy kind. And she was just like, no, we have business to do. Let's get it done. Let's get it handled. And very rules-based. So there is a lot of order in her life. There was a lot of very specific linear sort of things, delegations that needed to be done. And I mean, my life is very, very, very orderly. People come into my house and they're like, is your house always this clean? I'm like, yes, because there is a process and there is a plan for order to be maintained all the time. And my kids are always saying, it's clean. Why do we need to clean again? Because it's not really clean unless you clean it again.
I feel that.
But those kind of things, those like the process and order, but also the fact that she was defined by her own self. And it was an essence of definition. She didn't have to exert power. She just kind of walked with it. And I don't know if I appreciate it. And I'm kind of thinking about it now, but just the way she kind of glided around was that process of planning person and that powerful person that was able to create sort of this mini empire in Grenada. And I thought, yeah, that's what I want. I don't know what that is, but that's what I want.
She embodied it. It sounds like she just embodied that confidence. And she was an entrepreneur as well, right?
Yes. It was her aura, right? It was everything about her was, you know, a total feminist, powerful woman who looked after her community, but at the same time didn't take any flack from anybody. So she's feeding you with one spoon and chastising you with the other hand.
Wow. So she was in Grenada rather than Canada?
Is that no, she always stayed. Somebody always stayed back home. Mm-hmm. So the home was never left unattended.
I'm always struck and inspired by women like that who are able to do that decades ago, you know, when patriarchy was even more ingrained, you know, just to be able to say, forget that. I know my worth.
Right. And so I, the whole idea of patriarchy, that was never really a thing for me, because I just followed very strong women who, you know, you knew they loved you, but they weren't all soft and mushy about it. But they were very focused on, you know, what they wanted to achieve, whether it was entrepreneurship or otherwise, but while at the same time taking care of other people, like taking care of their broader community. Mm-hmm. So those were the elements that I really appreciated.
We've interviewed a few women who've come from like the Caribbean and talked about the differences of that kind of patriarchal messaging. And so I'm wondering if you think that there's a difference there than like the Canadian messaging is, you know, or maybe like America messaging is different in terms of like the limiting beliefs that are put on us and, you know.
Yeah, so it's interesting because we also had limiting beliefs, you know, like my other grandmother, you know, teaching me how to iron or my aunts cooking for their husbands and, you know, the expectation that you cook and you clean and you, yeah, no, I'm good. Thanks though.
Yeah.
I think just even being brought up early with my grandmother, Mrs. Caesar, on my dad's side, even those little interactions with her, just how fierce she was, made me know that I didn't have to do that. I didn't have to iron. I didn't have to cook. I didn't have to have this kind of role that women play. You could choose to do that, but you could also choose not to do that. So even in my house right now, I don't do morning shifts. I've never made lunches for my kids. I don't do that. Right. So
I'm so jealous.
My mantra is if you feed it, it will grow. So if you start doing morning shifts, you will get morning shifts. I don't like those. I don't do those. So, you know, you could either take those roles. They're not good or bad, right or wrong. They just are. And I've chosen to be very specific about how I live within my family, within my business, within my academics, et cetera.
Yeah, amazing. Because it does take a great deal of awareness to just be, that's what is shaping me or influencing me. And that's what, I'm going to say no to that. Instead, I'm going to live and model this other way.
And your mother, from a very early age.
Yeah. And your mother as well was a tough love sort of person, it seemed as well. Another strong woman. Is that how you would describe her? What was your mom?
Oh, very. So when I wrote my book, I dedicated it to my mom. And I said, to the iron that sharpens me, like, it wasn't to the love of my mom, but there's a great deal of love and respect and honor that I have for her, because she created the woman that was able to stand up to a prime minister when he, you know, says, put your needs aside to, you know, acquiesce to mine, to that type of misogyny. She created that. She, in that moment, you realize, like, where do you get the power to do that? Mm-hmm. So it is the iron, the grit, the sort of sharpness. It wasn't the pillow that sharpened me or the feather that sharpened me. It was the iron. So she needed to be tough. And I said, you know, I feared her while she feared for me and treated me the way she knew the world would. And so anything that I faced and overcome is because she was so steely in her upbringing, and knew, I'm pretty sure she could have been softer and cuddlier, but to what end? As a Black woman in a cold country, like literally, to what end would that serve?
So you sent her your manuscript before you published it. And so what was her sort of, you know, reception of that, and how did your relationship kind of manifest after that?
Yeah, so I sent it to her in November of 2020. And she said she laughed and she cried, like reading it through, right? And I think it was a real sort of manifestation of, look, this is where we are. We're not close in our relationship, but you, through these pages, you know, the amount of respect that I have for you, the love that I have for you, and the gratitude for who you grew me up to be. that I could have all of these life experiences. And one of the things that I've told her, which she hates when I tell her this, is that, you know, because every time I do something new, she's like, oh my God, really? Again, something new. And I said, you know, I want my tombstone at the end of my life to read, all she had left to do was die. Mm-hmm. Like, I want people at that service to be like, huh, thank God. We didn't know what else she was going to do. There was nothing else on the world that she could possibly do. We're glad to see her go, because like, give everybody else a chance to try something, because she's tried just about everything. Yeah. And that I just want to live and, you know, have fun. And I think one of the things that the experience of politics taught me, which was sort of the antithesis to my mother, is that even if you're this strong personality, you need to have some fun. Mm. Well, that was the painful, it was painful, but the beautiful part of it was that, oh, wait a minute. It doesn't have to be strong, persevere all the time. You could sort of have some fun with it. And that fun brought the love and the passion for what I do.
Mm. I want to hear more about the fun. But I want to first see whether your mom's preparation, you know, the way she made you steely to be able to deal with challenges, whether that showed up before politics. And so specifically around childhood, growing up, whether you experienced experiences of racism as a child or as a teenager, those early years.
Yeah, no, I did, but it was like, you know, kids would call me a brown noser and I'd be like, but like, I literally have a brown nose. I don't know what you're talking about. Or you look like chocolate. It's like, I don't know. Is this an insult to me? Because I actually do look like chocolate, right? So they were like things that I just kind of, are you stating the obvious to me? Like when they said things like that, you more derogatory terms, you know, it would pinch a little, but I would be like, well, is poo-poo the best thing that you could come up with? like, what? Right. So I kind of brushed that off. And I think little by little, you know, when I would say those kind of things to my mom, like this, the story of Alex that's in my book, where it was academically challenging, she would just be very sort of matter of fact. Well, if you want kids to make fun of you, you know, and you do nothing about it, that's up to you. Mm. And I'd be like, what? Like, where's the strategy in that? And she let me figure a lot of things out. I think when it came to like the sexism and the sort of abuse that I faced, I was able to sort of park things in my brain in a very particular way and compartmentalize my brain so that I could survive some of that stuff. And even, you know, my university years, like that requires a lot of survival. Mm-hmm. To go through 6 years of university, failing through each one and get a degree at the end, right? So there's a bit of resilience that is built into that sort of steely kind of upbringing that allows you to say, okay, here's the mistake that you made or the painful thing that has happened to you. What are we going to learn from that? And how are we going to not let it happen again and move on for it? But you need to figure this out on your own. Mm. So I think what that steely upbringing gave me the most of was that self-awareness, that ability to have some self-reflection, that ability to say, okay, let's sit and think about how you got yourself into this mess, whatever it is, whatever the situation was, how did you get yourself into it? And how are you going to get yourself out of it? Mm. And because you're not going to get answers from anybody else. And is that good or bad, right or wrong? I'm not quite sure. It stopped me from reaching out for help, but it also allowed me to be more self-reliant.
I think that might be something that's a little bit missing in today's parenting, right? Which is that idea that we leave our kids to figure things out on their own a little bit because we're always having the answers. We're saving them from themselves. And so I love that. And like you said, maybe there's some of the other parts that might've been missing too, right? But just being able to have that and then, you know, go forward. So it sounds like you have a lot of self-awareness. And I know that you were going back to your university and that is such a tough time, but you actually went into university for medicine. Was it like neuroscience or something like that? And then you wanted to be like a neurosurgeon and then were struggling, but it wasn't for you. So tell us about that time period and how you ended up, you know, figuring out that this wasn't for you and having that self-awareness. Cause a lot of people would be like, I said I was going to do this. I'm going to do this. I might be, you know, failing out of this or whatever. I'm going to persevere and I got to get that degree for that neurosurgeon. Cause that's what I said I was going to do. So what changed for you?
So it's interesting when you sit back and you try to figure things out, I didn't realize, and this may sound really hokey pokey, but I didn't realize how much the universe sort of gives you signs that you're on the right track. Mm-hmm. Right. So when I started to, after, you know, my university experience, I started as I went back to school actually to do a undergraduate fourth year course so that I could sort of figure out what do I do next? Because I didn't know that you could do any other thing in science but be a doctor. Like nurse wasn't an option, lab technician wasn't an option. All of these science related things were not options. So I went back and did a fourth year research course and entered into like the cognitive research space. And it was like, oh, but so I'm not a neurosurgeon, but I'm still in the brain lane. And, you know, working with people with dementia, working with people with, you know, traumatic brain injury or mild cognitive impairment. And like, so research student, research assistant, research coordinator were all related to the brain. Mm. And you don't really kind of, it gives me goosebumps when I think about it, but you don't really kind of put it together until you put it years later when you're really kind of reflecting on it and going, oh my gosh, I stayed in that brain lane. So, you know, you figure things out because sometimes you don't figure it out. Sometimes you just have to take what you get and don't get upset. Right? So I was put into this space because this is the one person that would accept me into a fourth year research program with my grades as bad as they were. She accepted me in and it just kept building from there. And after that, I was owning a company and the company that I owned very broad at the beginning, but started just really focusing in on brain research. And I've just stayed in the brain lane for years. I wasn't a neurosurgeon.
Yeah, but you
managed. I worked with a lot of them.
You managed to overcome those early years of struggling through university to launching a business and turning it into an award-winning research management company. Yes. So how did you do that? Like what part of you was able to do that?
So I think the thing with mistakes, when you make them, if you're able to reflect on them long enough, allows you to get that sort of perspective of the lesson. So what do I need to learn about why I failed out of university? Well, first of all, let's focus. Let's sit and focus on it. And I remember Carol Greenwood, who was the person that I did my fourth year research project with, Dr. Greenwood, saying, when you're doing research, when you're doing anything, you have to just focus. Like, don't get distracted by the shiny things on the side. And I thought, well, my whole university life was getting distracted by the shiny things on the side. So once I started the business, I kept it really focused on research management. But also, I had to really focus in on the business part of it. So if I could go back a little bit, when I was a research student, I work with Carol Greenwood, but the next job after that was a research assistant with Don Stuss, Dr. Don Stuss, who passed away in 2019. And he said to me, you know, I said, can you give me a reference letter so that I could get into a science program? I want to do a master's of science at least and stay in the lab. And he said, I'll write you a reference letter, but I don't see you sitting behind a bench doing this research for the rest of your life. I see you doing business. Mm-hmm. And it floored me. I was like, no, I don't really see that for myself, but you know, I'll take your word for it. You took a chance on me. I'll take a chance on you and get into business. And so taking those two things were getting into business and then the focus on research allowed me to then think about how I could remain focused without getting distractions. So when I started my business, I didn't put my face, my name, anything on advertising, because that would distract. I don't know if working with in a neuroscience space, which is pretty much dominated by older white men, if having a picture of a young black woman would detract them from wanting to work with me. So you remove the shiny thing, which is usually driven by your ego anyway, and focus in on what service delivery can you offer. I didn't go to banks to get loans because loans enable companies while customers grow the business. Mm-hmm. So I didn't take my time chasing loans or venture capitalists. I focused on the service delivery model and grew the company from that.
This is like, there's so much information coming out. And like you said, you're like, but I didn't stay in one thing. I'm really thinking about how much you must be in your feminine at all times, because the changing and the evolving and the transitioning, like that's a very feminine flow thing. And so It's like you mentioned that the universe had your back in guiding you in all of these different areas, and you were open and listening to it, which is, I think, so incredible. Yeah, we can do that.
Yes.
All for that. And so then you have this business, but all of a sudden you're going into politics. Like where did that, you know, story enter? When did that, and what drew you into this whole political realm?
So in 2013, so the company is now 8 years old. We're about to get to our 10-year anniversary. I'm getting a little bored, as entrepreneurs tend to do. And I'm thinking, well, what do I do next? 10-year anniversary, do I take the company global, international, or do I leave and go into a private corporation? Two options, 2013, and it's September. So I'm like, let me do a PhD and just probably try to figure it out over the next couple of years. Imposter syndrome sets in and I'm like, I can't do a PhD, even though I got accepted. I can't do a PhD. I am not smart enough to do this. I'm going to go back and do another MBA. But universe always has your back, right? So not something I knew then, but I know now. Dropped out, went into an executive MBA program at Rotman in September of 2013. In December of 2013, there is a politics component to the program. And it's the first time I'm ever taking a political science class, and the professor talks about political capital and, you know, how political capital could help you with a particular business problem that you're having. Park that. At the time, I'm running Canada's first national epidemiology study on neurological conditions. We're looking at scope, impact, health services, and risk factors for things like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, epilepsy across the age continuum. And we're finding that people either have to move from province to province because they can't afford their medications, mm-hmm. or they get divorced because their combined income makes their income a little too high for them to qualify for services. So they divorce. At the services from one partner. And I'm like, political capital helps you solve a business problem. I have a massive business problem here that's happening on a national scale. Let me get some political capital. And so in December of 2013, I'm like, how do I do this? Google, how do I get some political capital? Oh, join a political party. Well, that will. Why didn't I think of that? Okay, which party do I join? I always vote Liberal. Okay, how do I get involved in the Liberal Party? Pay my $10, click send. That is February of 2014, which is less than 2 months later. March 8th, International Women's Day, talk about feminine flow and the universe just opening up. International Women's Day, I get this email that says, invite her to run. You know, a woman who's interested in politics and has the skills and characteristics to represent the federal government, to represent their riding in the next federal election. I'm like, do I know her?
I am her.
Like, respond, hi, Justin Trudeau.
Oh my God.
I'm interested. Sign me up.
Amazing. So, I mean, you are interested because you're trying to build a political capital for your company, but also you were drawn to the Liberal Party because at the time they were promising bold transformation, right? Diversity, feminism, all of that. Yeah. And so you throw your hat in the ring and you say, I'm going to go up against Jim Flaherty and Whitby. So tell us about that, because it's a really interesting story, the process and how you got the seat.
Yeah. So Whitby, is a, you know, a town of 130,000 people. It's smaller, it's larger than the whole island nation of Grenada. Mm-hmm. And it is conservative. So Jim Flaherty has been the minister, the member of parliament here, but he's also the minister of finance. His wife is, you know, in the Ontario legislature. It's just total conservative through and through. They've never elected a person of color, let alone a Black woman. And I'm like, yeah, but I'll put on a good, I'll run a great campaign. And, you know, I'll lose to like the Flaherty legacy, but I'll put on a good campaign and I'll gain some political capital because I don't play to lose. But in this case,
mm-hmm. So your goal wasn't to win the seat necessarily. It
was I'll take one for the team. I'll lose. I might lose this one, but I'm still going to achieve the objective because I'm going to put on such a great campaign. Mm-hmm. And then, so this is March 8th, middle of March, he resigns as minister. And then in the beginning of April, he passes away. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm feeling horrible, but I'm also doing the math, which means, you know, carry the one, add the two. You're in an election in less than 6 months.
And you can win.
I'm like, I don't know anything about politics.
I love that, like, you know, fake it till you make it, almost a little bit of that. And, you know, I don't think that you were faking it so much because you did have so much experience in business and, you know, in the interests of the areas that you were working into, but right. You were, you know, sweeping vote, and won this election, becoming the MP and then handpicked by Trudeau to, become his parliamentary secretary. And so for some, this might be like a dream come true. This might be like, this is what I've waited for all my life. And I'm, you know, climbing the ladder into politics. And so what was that experience like for you?
Let me back up a little. So I did lose that by-election in 2014. And then I won the general election in 2015 because I would lose to Flaherty, but I would be darned if I lost to that person that I lost to again. So I changed my strategy, won the general election. And then 2015, December, called by the prime minister as his parliamentary secretary. And so again, I think that there's a beauty in not being the doe-eyed person who was like, oh, I want to be in politics all my life. Mm-hmm. And now that I'm here, I'm ascending to this position. I'm just like, okay, you know, I got a title, whatever. So I step into his office and I say, let me tell you something. It's like the worst thing a Black woman could tell you when they sit down to talk to you, because that means like we're being like, this is like, pay attention. We're being mm-hmm. deadly serious on this mm-hmm. one. So let me tell you something. I'm not interested in, I'm hoping that you didn't pick me as your parliamentary secretary because to fill any gender or racial gaps that you have in your cabinet. I am perfectly happy being a member of parliament for Whitby. I don't need a title. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, of course not. I'm not, that's totally not why you're here. You're here on merit. And it's like, clearly I'm here on merit, but I don't need any title. And it was for me one of the most difficult positions that I've ever had. Because as the year progressed, it became embarrassingly realized that I was there to fill a gap, in particular a racial gap, as the only Black woman who was elected out of 338 members of parliament, let alone the only Black woman within the government, right? Mm. Out of the 180 plus people. But it was embarrassingly tokenistic the way that, you know, the duties I was called to do. So not allowed to speak for him in the House of Commons, not allowed to talk, which is what a parliamentary secretary does if your minister is not available, which he usually wasn't. He was flying a lot internationally. We were supposed to tag team in, represent them on the floor of the House. I was told I was not allowed to do that, not allowed to answer any questions. He was doing a lot of international travel. was only asked to do 3 international trips, all with a very specific Black focus. And I tried to resign from the position, which if I had to do something again, I would have absolutely made sure that I resigned from the position as early as April of 2016, because I knew the direction we were going in, but I didn't want to embarrass the government at the same time. And you're also in self-preservation mode, because you're like, okay, you're parliamentary secretary to the prime minister, you're going to quit, you're going to embarrass him. What happens to you when you embarrass like one of the most powerful people in the country? What happens then?
Especially because it wasn't a time like right now.
Right.
You would be fully supported by everybody.
Right.
At that time, people were still, you know.
Yeah, that would be ungrateful. It would have come back to hit me as the bad one. And nobody would have been able to see what is happening underneath. Like why I'm saying, no, this, I told you that this is not what I wanted. Mm. And I guess the expectations would have been, be grateful. Mm-hmm. You're there. Mm-hmm. Don't complain and just sit pretty and do what you're told.
But even when you look back at some of the footage, you know, to prepare for this podcast, I look back at some of the footage with Maxime Bernier and the things you were saying to him, calling him out for colorblindness and white privilege, you know, feeling like you weren't getting a lot of support for calling him out on those things. But if you had you said those things today, you would have had a more receptive audience.
Well, it's not that I was feeling like I wasn't getting support. I wasn't getting support, right? I was being gaslit internally by my own party, not supporting. And you know, the thing is, it's not that it wasn't supporting me. When Maxime Bernier was talking about colorblindness, he was referring to our budget. So the federal 2018 budget, and said the investments that we were making in the Black communities across Canada were divisive and that we shouldn't be making those investments. This is the first time in Canadian history that Black communities have been mentioned specifically in a federal budget in 150 something years, the first time, and he calls it divisive. So it wasn't so much that they didn't protect me, they weren't even willing to protect their own budget at the expense of possibly looking like they were protecting me. So they didn't say, Maxime, this is not divisive. This is something that's needed for equity seeking groups or anything like that. There was no protection of the budget because they knew protecting the budget would have meant protecting me. Mm-hmm. Second, they know my riding is 70% white, that it is a conservative riding, that, you know, they probably, you know, there's some people that are going to agree with Maxime. And they didn't even want to protect winning this riding again by saying, no, you can't come after one of our own like that. That doesn't even make sense. Like what she's saying is true.
That for me was a betrayal.
Yeah, I felt being gaslit from people outside who don't get it, whatever. But being gaslit internally because they're not putting out the fire is worse.
Especially
when you have the capacity to do so, like you're holding the fire extinguisher and you're just saying, just hope she like flames out on her own.
So you're a woman, you're a Black woman, you're in this environment, you know, that is essentially not designed for you. And so would you say, you know, here we are like a mere 3 years later, what's changed? Has anything changed? You know, I think that there's this notion that people are more woke and aware and, you know, the government is working towards some of these changes that you've experienced. But is that real? Do you believe that things have actually changed in that environment?
So it's interesting being Selena in 2018 and then witnessing 2020. And understanding the capacity we had in 2018 to actually have a candid conversation about race in Canada and show our mettle and lead a conversation, as opposed to 2020 when we're following an existing conversation. And before I answer your question about whether we've changed, if there's any change, we have to sort of take a detour through 2019 and blackface, right? So between 2018 and 2020, we have blackface that happens in 2019. And at the time, I'm an independent. I have no reason to reach out to PMO or to the Prime Minister about this situation. But I know my community, the Black communities across Canada, are going to be hurt by this. And I know that there are going to be people who are going to need to learn a lesson. This isn't a learning opportunity for us all. Some of us have already learned this lesson. We know what blackface is. So I sent the Prime Minister's office a note saying, you cannot just apologize for blackface. What you need to do, because you're in Manitoba at the Museum of Human Rights, you need to, number one, just like we do with our children, you say you're sorry. What did you learn? You need to teach Canadians who don't know what this is, a learning moment for them, not us. So you're in Manitoba. You need to talk about how minstrel shows were rampant in the prairies, how dehumanizing they were to Black people in this country. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. What did you learn and what you're going to do to correct it? Now you need to hold yourself accountable. Now, what are you going to do to correct it? He didn't do either of those things. Mm-hmm. And that really made me upset. So watching 2020, the woke Prime Minister, do we see any more Black representation in our cabinet? No. Do we see any more representation in the federal public service in terms of deputy ministers and assistant deputy ministers? No. Yeah. In fact, the federal government is being sued with a class action lawsuit for the way over the last decades Black people have been treated. People have worked there 20, 30 years and never receive a promotion. Could you imagine? Mm-hmm. And so have you made changes to the Equity Act to address that? Mm-hmm. No. So there's a lot of performative throw money at a situation stuff happening, but when it comes to holding a pen and making actual changes to the internal infrastructure of the federal government, that's not happening. So are they woke? They probably opened their eyes, but they're still not looking in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. You've said before that if you're going to be the one to shatter the ceiling, you're going to get cut, right? That glass is going to fall on you. And in a way, that seems to be what's happened to you in a way, because you were leading the conversation in government, in politics, on a lot of these issues before George Floyd. Right before George Floyd, gaslit by your own party. But you've also said you have no regrets. So, you know, looking back, would you have done it all over again?
Oh, for sure. Mm. Absolutely. So I made a very conscious decision in September of 2017, that when the House returned after the summer, that I was going to be different. I wasn't going to be, so for the first 2 years of politics, you know, you're kind of figuring out what to do. You know, everybody's talking about being a minister. Maybe I should like play that game. Maybe I should be nice and, you know, be, and then I was like, but that it started feeling so wrong, you know, just being quiet and not sort of taking stands on things that I knew were not right. And just sort of, you know, saying things internally. And people would say to me after, oh, you know, Selena, you can't just, you know, say things out loud. You have to work with a team and you have to, well, I was there for 4 years. What do you think? I didn't talk to anybody for 4 years. I tried working with the team. I tried doing some of these things internally. And then in September of 2017, I said, the gloves come off. They keep giving me a microphone and they keep giving me one of the biggest megaphones in the country. Whose stories am I going to amplify? What am I going to do with this moment? Because I don't have a guaranteed 4 more years. I only have this moment and they can't fire me. So what am I going to do in these 4 years to make a difference for the people that need it the most, that nobody is talking about? Mm-hmm. And so that decision was made, but it also comes with doing the mental math, right? So everything I've done since September of 2017, the braids speech, Maxime Bernier, resigning as Parliamentary Secretary for International Development, or being public with what happened with me and the Prime Minister, all had a mental cost to it. Meaning I had to do the math of what would happen after 2019. Will I ever work in Canada again? My answer to that was no. Mm. I didn't think I'd ever work in Canada again. And from October of 2019 to October 2020, I didn't. Mm. I applied for job after job. I called other male MPs who had left. They had gotten consulting jobs with the consulting firms and GR firms around Ottawa. I didn't get one single phone call. And I reached out to every single one of my contacts in those corporations and said,
That is so angering.
Yeah. So there's a cost that comes with that. But do I regret it? I already did the math before I did it. So no.
I think that calculated, you know, the decisions, the calculations that you have made over the years have definitely benefited you into, you know, every new path that you've taken on. And then you write this book, Can You Hear Me Now? Tell us about that title. How did it come to you? Why was this important for you at this time of your life to now write this story?
Yeah, so I didn't come up with the title. My husband did. Mm. And we were going back and forth, you know, with Miss Independent or, you know, something like that. And he just said, Can you hear me now? I sent it to my agent or my editor. And she's like, that's the title. Mm. And this was before 2020. Right. So like all of this stuff is already in play. So it goes, we're going full circle here to like the universe sort of opening up. And, you know, 2020 happens and it's kind of like, what a perfect title mm-hmm. for this book. Can you hear me now? Mm-hmm. But I think more importantly, related to some of the stories that are earlier in the book about the pain that people go through. And how I end the book, you know, saying that it's not enough to hear my voice. We need to hear yours too. So mm-hmm. I want others to take that title and make it their own, right? So it's not just about me saying, mm-hmm. can you hear me now? To the prime minister, or to anybody else who has sort of defied me along the way. Mm-hmm. It's to Canadians to say, can you hear me now? And have that sort of amplified ripple effect where we hear the democracy. Because the power has always been with the people. Mm-hmm. We just don't listen to the people enough to actually make the changes that are required.
It was just nominated for the Shaughnessy Award, right? Your book. And it's part memoir, part self-help. And so you're hoping that people will read it and then amplify their own voices. But you've also said that the process of writing for yourself, the memoir part, was healing for you.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us a bit about writing. And is that something that you continue to do to support yourself?
So you see, I have a pen in my hand. Yeah. I do. I think, you know, we always say that, you know, our plate is full. It has so much stuff in it. And then, you know, I remember talking to my husband and saying that, you know, my plate is full. I don't have time for you. I don't have time for me. I have to finish this job. I have to like deal with the kids. That's all I have room for. But as I started writing, I realized that I was emptying a lot of the toxic stuff that I was holding on to that I thought I was not holding on to, but like writing about my past. And then my plate kind of just got empty.
Mm-hmm. Were you anxious before that? Did you have anxiety or any other? Well, I know you had the nervous breakdown, but sometimes we have anxiety. You don't realize that that's what is the unprocessed stuff that's causing it, right?
For sure. But we're holding. So even in the book, mm-hmm. I say, I owned my mistakes. My mistakes didn't own me, but I owned them and kept them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like you could own your mistakes and like throw them in the trash, mm-hmm. right? You like get rid of them, but mm-hmm. I owned them and I kept them. Yeah. And then as I started writing, I think that process was very, very healing and releasing. Not that it didn't make me anxious. Mm-hmm. So I think releasing it right at the beginning of the pandemic happening, I was seeing my psychiatrist every day for that first little bit. And I think that's maybe separate or maybe contributing, but there was a sort of sigh of relief mm-hmm. getting all that stuff out and saying, no, my plate is not full. It just had a lot of junk. Mm-hmm. Now I could focus on my husband and more importantly, myself, healing, taking time, stopping to smell the roses, doing my nails, doing the things that I take the time to do because I'm actually appreciating. And this is, I think, is the happiest or the most joyful I've been, the most peaceful I've been in my entire life. And I'm not hustling. I'm enjoying living.
That the idea of experiencing joy, like I can feel it. We can feel it even through the screen. It's just like, that's what we're all really seeking. And I think that when you are carrying that, as Liz said, I mean, it lives in your nervous system. You experience the anxiety or you don't even realize what is there, but you've really painted a picture for me about when your plate is full. It's all the trauma that's living within you. And when you can start to clear that away, it's like you have all of this space inside of you. And so you didn't even know that you were carrying this trauma around, which I think a lot of us don't even realize that we're so full that any next thing, you know, we don't have the capacity, right? To
tilt. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so for you, this manifested in a couple of different ways, but with your mental health, and you've talked about your depression or depressions in your past, and you're a big advocate for, you know, being open about mental health now. And I had a similar experience to you. I had postpartum depression after my third child. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the signals, as you've mentioned, were missed as well. My doctor, in fact, said, you know, Julie, I don't know, like, you're just so strong. So what could all these symptoms be, right? Like, and, you know, like literally the next day or next week, I was like, you know, nervous breakdown, couldn't walk, transported to the hospital, basically. So tell us a little bit about that experience and what you've learned about embracing and embodying your own mental health and being an advocate for that.
Oh my gosh. So I just want to go back to the fact that the trauma, there has been an American Psychological Association in 2018, 2019, put out reports on the trauma that is caused by microaggressions, you know, whether racial, gender related or otherwise, microaggressions cause trauma. So we do hold that, and it manifests itself physically and mentally. So that is a reality. And one of the reasons why I'm such a strong advocate for talking about mental health and embracing it is because I now know the harm that it could cause. And, you know, as Black women in particular, we're told right from birth, you know, you have to be twice as good, work twice as hard, study twice as long, because you have two strikes, you're a woman and you're Black. Mm-hmm. So you have to overcompensate. And I'm not saying that we may ever stop doing that, but what we have to start doing is understanding that working so hard is not a sustainable way of living. Coupled on top of that is the sexism and racism or the massage noir that we have to deal with, causing trauma. And we have to deal with that. So for me, just talking about it gives, I don't want to say permission, but it allows other people to know that, okay, what was she experiencing? And I'm very detailed because I didn't cry all the time. And that's why I didn't really think it was depression. But it was, you know, the mood and the motivation and the irritability and those kinds of things, which my doctor's telling me about. And remember, I worked in neuro space for 10 years. Should I not know this? I didn't. And he's like, oh, well, this medication will help your mood and this will help your motivation because they're two different things. I didn't know that. And this will help you with your irritability and, you know, asking these questions. And then the other thing is being compliant. So earlier this year, I posted how I was compliant with my medication for the first time. And then I get DMs from people who are like, I'm glad you put that because my partner's not compliant and I'm really upset with them about not being compliant. And it's, look, honey, nobody wants to be compliant because your brain is not working properly. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start feeling better, you stop taking your medication. Mm-hmm. But for this year, I've been compliant because I know how much damage it does to my hippocampus when I'm not. So that's what I'm trying to prevent. And just putting that out there allows people who are going through this journey some respite, mm-hmm. some ability to say, okay, it's not only me that's messing up or depressed or not doing well.
You're being really relatable to other people, but also when you speak about these microaggressions, I mean, that's chronic stress. That's chronic traumas that you're experiencing through your whole life. So yeah, I definitely think bringing light to that to share with others is going to help others really see that, oh my God, I might have been experiencing this myself as well. Well,
there's a world of difference in being the white male who walks into politics and you get constant affirmation that you belong here, you're in the right place, and being the Black female who walks in and you get, you know, your name double checked at the door or triple checked, or just, you know, constant signs that maybe this is not where you belong, right? There's stress and trauma for the latter situation.
Yeah, but even the physical space doesn't have any representation that you've ever belonged there. So there's nothing within the parliamentary precinct that shows that Black women contributed to our democracy in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So I'd have to look at Kim Campbell's picture and be like, girl, how you doing? You hanging in? Because she was the only close representation of me in the space and as a white woman. And I would literally walk by and talk to her and say, you hanging, you good? And then find some way to keep going.
I'm conscious of the time. I feel like we could keep you for another 2 hours because we wanted to ask about your spirituality and so many other things. But, you know,
the spirituality, ask about the spirituality.
Okay. We want to know about your spirituality and how that supports your mental well-being and what it means to you.
So it's interesting because when we passed medical assistance in dying in 2016, I believe it was 2016, there were protests outside of my church. So I'm pro-choice, pro-LGBTQ, pro-medical assistance. And I'm pro whatever you want to do. We will help you like not make bad decisions, but look, there is autonomy for people. And as a Black person, as a woman, I know what it's like in some point in our history to not have rights. Okay. So I'm not about to infringe on anybody's rights. So we passed medical assistance in dying. I'm going to church and the Twitter starts going. I saw you today. You took the Eucharist. You shouldn't be doing that.
Why not?
Because I'm pro LGBTQ.
Oh my gosh.
Pro choice. Pro, you shouldn't be doing that. Pro made, right?
Yeah.
Catholic Church.
I saw you again today. You took this is really triggering. So I know it's triggering for me. So if anybody's watching,
we're both raised Catholic. I was raised very Catholic. So
yeah. So again, a Twitter message. I saw you again today. You took the Eucharist. You know you shouldn't do that. So I would go to church and then I would stop getting the Eucharist because I just didn't want those messages. And then medical assistance passed and they were outside the church with those aborted fetuses things with my name on it. And I thought, I go to church for peace.
Of course.
And to connect spiritually. I'm not going to continue going and make somebody else's experience of having peace disrupted because they need to see that on the way. So I stopped going, which was by far. So this is 2016, just had a nervous breakdown. And I tweeted the person. I said, I hope you're satisfied. I'm no longer going to church. I hope this is what your God wanted. Oh. And so they responded and said, no, no, no. And I said, well, you know, damage is done. Yatch. Like, yeah. So then I'm like going through this like continued spiral. Right. And then I just start picking up other books. Oh no, somebody starts, my high school friend calls me out of the blue. And I'm like, Catherine, what are you calling me for? She's like, she starts talking about meditation. I'm like, you called me related to a work issue. I thought like you had an immigration issue. Like what actual federal government issue do you have? And she starts talking about meditation. And so I start practicing and she gives me books and she tells me to read this and, you know, all these different things and John Dyer. And I start this practice of spirituality as opposed to religion. Ciao.
Freedom there.
Ah,
freedom is
we
over there.
Feel you on that one.
What? Then yeah. I have Hindu beads on this side. Oh, I have the cross there. I have Buddha in the backyard.
You got them all.
I have the Bible. I'm like, I don't know which one of y'all running this universe, but whichever one it is, yeah. I'm gonna be good.
I love that. I mean, what's the universality between all of them, right? What's the common underlying theme, which my thing is it's beautiful underneath all of them. If you go get to the heart of them, there's a truth there. Exactly. That's where I'll hang out.
Yes. And that's where the joy is for me, right?
Absolutely.
Because yeah. I'm at a space where I could practice that mindfulness, that realization that we're all connected, that beauty of like the grass. You know, I always say especially when I'm doing equity work, like I'm like, we want to save the grass, like the planet from climate change, but we don't want to like each other. How are we going to save the grass when we don't like each other? Right. So there's a simplicity to spirituality that is so beautiful when you understand how connected and how amazing we are to be here.
I love that you've just tied in the spirituality to your activism as well, right? It's like you have to have that sense of spirituality, that grounding, that inner knowing in order to take on what needs to be taken on. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And also the idea of bringing yourself to that present moment, right? With your mindfulness, with your meditation. And I know you've talked about how this past year you've really focused on staying present. But one of our questions is we like to ask is, what is your afterglow? And you're the queen of reinvention. You've done it so many times. And so, you know, you've got this beautiful book out there that I want everybody to read. And what is your afterglow? Where do you see yourself in, you know, 5-10 years? Where do you see the world?
Yeah. So one of the things, if I may, one of the things with my equity work is understanding that if you want equity outside of your organization or outside of you in your organization, that you have to have equity within you. So it has to have, you have to start with empathy. You have to understand where people are coming from. Then you could actually put forward a strategy within your workplace to sustain that. You can't be someone who is toxic on the inside and expect your organization to have equitable outcomes on the outside. You set that tone. Mm-hmm. And so my afterglow is really helping people understand how powerful empathy is as part of an equity framework, as part of that process. I'm actually trying to get someone to do a doctorate with that allows me to study that very important intersection. Because if you have the empathy to see people, which is something that was missing from politics, I felt like people didn't see me, right? At the intersection of that empathy and equity is the person that we are going to leave behind, whether we're talking about climate change or a global pandemic or racial inequality, or any other geopolitical issue that's happening in the world, the most vulnerable and often the poorest are going to be right in the middle of that. And if we do not start to see people, especially the poorest and most vulnerable, we'll never get to a point in this world where we have equity in our communities, in our country, in our globe. It's not gonna happen. Something has to shift. We've tried this DEI model, this diversity, equity, inclusion model for decades now. Let's think about it, reframe it, and think about it differently. Empathy on the inside and actual spiritual caring for yourself on the inside. And then that comes out on the outside.
I just want to repeat that. You've said empathy is at the intersection of equity. That's beautiful.
And increasing our capacity to care, right, for ourselves and for others is huge. Yes. And makes me think of your brain science too, and what the changes that happen in the brain, right, when we light up those empathic brain waves.
Yes, and that's what I want to say from my doctoral perspective, like the neuroscience of it, the social impact, as well as the leadership impact. Mm. But universities are very siloed. So they're like, well, what do you mean you want to study empathy from a neuroscience, but a leadership? So you want to go to business school? No, I don't want to go to business school. I want to be in the neuroscience part. Well, we can't talk to each other. We don't do that.
Yeah. Well, the siloed approach doesn't work anymore, I don't think, in this new world. Yeah. You are amazing. You are a beautiful, inspiring woman. And I'm so grateful for this hour with you. I wish we had two more because we wanted your parenting tips. We wanted so much. I'd love to just talk about spirituality. We could have gotten into so much, but this was a true gift to have this time with you.
Thank you. Well, you have to bring me back.
Let's maybe we can just wind down with one sort of final thought about what you might have to say. You're so authentic and courageous, but maybe to say, to share with other women out there who are, you know, looking to find their voice as you have, what you can share with them.
Yeah. So the one thing that I would say is that this is not a competition. Mm. We're not competing. You don't have to be a Selena disruptor doing the mental math of not being able to work again the day in your own life. You may need that job, sis. Do not disrupt, right? We're not trying to get those kind of goals. So what I do want to say is that the capacity to support each other in our individually styled ways of finding success, however you define that, supporting each other allows for that to happen. It's not a competition, it's a collaboration. And when we collaborate, even when it looks like we're going after the same thing, we're not cutting into each person's slice of pie so that, you know, if I get something and you're there, I'm going to cut into your slice of pie. That's not how it works. Mm-hmm. When I come in, then we put our ingredients together. We make a bigger pie so everybody gets a slice and everybody can eat. Mm-hmm. And that's what we want it to be. And I think if anybody on the planet could do that, it is women. But I think what our feminist movement has done is created, it's stratified and created a hierarchy of women or gender diverse individuals where it used to be men, like the patriarchy did it, and then feminism stratified it more. And then, yo, we need to like just put the brakes on this, right? And figure out how to do it better. And I think that comes from an empathetic perspective, but it also comes from a knowing that we're not competing.
That's beautiful. Beautiful, Selena. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This was wonderful. And you have to have me back because I have notes on here that I didn't even say.
Oh, wow.
Love that you're like taking notes too. Like we're taking notes. You said so many, you like... Essence. You said, I want to talk about essence. We got to talk about that. There's so many things. So.
And I do want to close by saying this. Thank you for using this platform for having these conversations. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who say, you know, I just have a little podcast. I just have a little this, I just have a little that. No, the little things in aggregate is what changes the world. And in order for us to have the empathetic courage to change the world, we need to share our stories. And these platforms allow that to happen. And so my thanks is to you for allowing me to be here and to just share a little piece of my story. So thank you.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know, what do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.